sixth case of the day, U.S. v. Farmer, 12-3132. Mr. Holmes.
May it please the court, counsel. Rodney Holmes on behalf of defendant appellate Franchi Farmer. Ms. Farmer was convicted of, on a two-count indictment of bank robbery by force and the use of a weapon during a crime of violence. The conviction occurred after a three-day jury trial. Several days after the verdict, I believe 2 days after the verdict, counsel, myself, received a phone call from an alternate juror in the case. The alternate juror had taken the time to Google counsel's to find his contact information and ultimately provided an affidavit concerning statements that he heard during from fellow jurors during the trial. One of the statements indicated that a juror on the second day of trial, and from the timing of the affidavit, it was before the government presented evidence about the phone records and fingerprints. That had to have occurred at the either during or before the second break of day two of the jury trial. And that statement indicated that the juror said, I wrote my verdict down immediately and haven't heard anything to change it. Okay. The basis of motion for new trial was that affidavit and those statements. Now, Rule 606 of the Federal Rules of Evidence clearly states that you cannot use statement to impeach a jury verdict. But this court has indicated in U.S. versus Morales and U.S. versus Kimberlin that this Rule 606D does not apply to premature deliberations, which in essence is what occurred in this case. Now, that statement that I wrote my verdict down early on does several things. It disregards the presumption of innocence, and the defendant is now operating, at least in one juror's mind, from a position of a presumption of guilty. Also, it shifts the burden of proof. The burden of proof in a criminal trial remains at all stages with the government. The juror's statement, I have not heard anything to change my verdict, that was written early on in the either the first, probably the first day of a trial, definitely no later than the morning of the second day. What that does is that shifts the burden to the defendant to prove her innocence. It shifts the burden from the government to the defendant. There were other statements. One was, can we just, I'm summarizing this statement. Can we go ahead and just get this out the way or vote now and a laugh, a ha-ha afterwards? One of the things in Morales and Kimberlin, they both indicate that the proper mechanism for dealing with such statements is not a hearing, because a hearing, bringing this juror in before the court for to have a hearing, runs afoul of Rule 606B. What the court can do is find that the statements are presumptively prejudicial to the defendant. They can presume that
if we were to adopt that position, Mr. Holmes, wouldn't we make essentially every verdict vulnerable to this kind of a challenge?
No, not at all, Your Honor. And one of the things about this case that's different, and it's similar to the standard that this court uses when dealing with the credibility of a witness. The standard for credibility of a witness is that the jury and the district court were there. They were able to see the body language, to see the expressions, to best position to determine what the credibility of this witness. In this case, this alternate juror was there. Counsel wasn't there. The government wasn't there. The court wasn't there.
These were not
suggestions of some outside influence on the jurors. It suggests the jurors had not followed the judge's instructions and made their minds up early.
Correct. It's not an outside influence, but this alternate juror was there,
and we would have to treat under your approach that affidavit would have to be treated as conclusive evidence, prejudice presumed, new trial must be ordered, right?
Yes, in this particular situation.
What would prevent efforts to bring forth such accusations in any case, especially if they must conclusively be presumed true and evidence of prejudice?
It's just this particular case. And what's important, counsel did not seek to contact any of the jurors.
Not in this case, but it's certainly conceivable.
And that could be a distinction, Your Honor. This is a situation where an alternate juror that was there.
How would we find out without holding a hearing? If you're saying that the distinction here is on depends on whether the former juror came forward on his or her own versus being contacted by counsel. If that's the distinction, how would we do that without holding a hearing?
Well, a hearing could be held to determine how the contact was made without going into the merits, Your Honor,
Let me just share with you my concern about this rule. I'm quoting, I believe it's Justice O'Connor's majority or opinion for the court in Tanner, saying it is not at all clear, however, that the jury system could survive such efforts to perfect it. We have a lot of jurors we all know jurors don't always act perfectly and sometimes get impatient. Some state court systems even encourage early deliberations and discussions before. There's nothing unconstitutional about it. But what you're proposing here is a rule that would make every conviction vulnerable.
Not necessarily. I disagree with that position that it would make every conviction vulnerable. This is a distinct case that actually differs from the case law and the facts in Kimberlin and Morales. You have a juror that hears statements that doesn't believe they're a joke, but based on the actions, that believes that they constitute a serious violation, that on his own looks up the information to contact counsel and provides an affidavit. This is not a situation where, the counsel is going looking for something as far as jury misconduct. If we
reverse on this basis, wouldn't there be an open invitation to counsel to search for that kind of thing?
Your Honor, we're dealing with lawyers, and lawyers look for any opening to
exactly
wiggle.
They have websites and they invite comments and so forth.
It is not at all clear that the jury system could survive such efforts to perfect it.
But that may be the case, Your Honor, but to place this burden on Ms. Farmer for clearly the statement that I wrote my verdict down at the beginning of the trial and haven't heard anything to change it yet, it's prejudicial. If not for other members of the jury, we know one juror, that approach is prejudicial to the defendant. Constitutional rights to a fair trial, constitutional right to have the burden of proof remain with the government, the constitutional right to have a presumption of innocence. That is problematic for Ms. Farmer in this particular case. I believe that it can be narrowly tailored and factually specific to...
How would we do that?
How would you narrowly...
Mm-hmm.
First of all, in a situation where the defense attorneys will go out and attempt to make contact, and I believe in some districts there are rules that prevent counsel from contacting the jury. So if that rule is violated, that is a exclusion from the case, from the issue being upheld on appeal. again, the key is that this is a situation where a juror saw these as problematic to the extent that they took their time and energy to actually find counsel's contact information. I'm in Belleville, Illinois, St. Louis area. This trial occurred in Benton, Illinois. The alternate juror lived in Carbondale. This is not a situation where it's you have, for example, you have one African American on the jury and the majority is white, and they feel that because the defendant is African American that something else is going on. There was not a minority on the entire panel to pick from. So this is a all-white jury. The alternate juror is white, and they found these instances so egregious that they took the time to contact counsel. And that's the distinguishing factor, Your Honor, with the rules in place in most district courts that counsel cannot contact the jurors. That is one way to limit this situation, Your Honor. I see my time is up. If there are no questions, I'll reserve for a rebuttal.
All right, and we'll give you a minute for rebuttal as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Leggetts.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel.
Morning.
Like Mr. Holmes, I was the trial counsel below. And I believe the court is focused in on the appropriate, really, for lack of a better word, policy issues at stake in really in any appeal of this nature. The I believe also that counsel is focusing on prejudice, maybe in a very generalized sense, or maybe in a I was taught evidence that there's a difference between logical relevance and legal relevance. In this case, I think there's also a distinction to be made between logical prejudice and legal prejudice. And Paul, the counsel can certainly extrapolate logical prejudice, perhaps from the information that he was able to glean from the alternate juror. This court, the Supreme Court in Tanner, the common law, all imposed a legal prejudice component to this type of an issue arising before the court, and that is the legal prejudice underpinning that has to lie at the basis of any valid claim that the defendant is trying to advance today is extrajudicial influence on the jury. There is some also logical reasons to that, because extrajudicial influences on the jury involves juror consideration of factors that haven't been subjected to the adversarial process, that haven't been subjected to the rules of evidence, that haven't been subjected to the additional safeguards that accrue to a criminal jury trial. Here, to the extent that there was a premature validation of the evidence in this case, at least it was the evidence in this case. At least it was evidence that had been subjected to the jury system. And so while I have sympathy for Mr. Holmes's argument that there was prejudice, what this court and what the common law and the Supreme Court and our system of justice demands is the legal prejudice of there being extrajudicial influences on the jury. There are very good reasons for that. From this court's questions of Mr. Holmes, it's apparent that this panel recognizes what those reasons are. And if this panel has no questions for me.
If this information had been made known to the court during the trial, do you think a hearing on it would have been required?
I think the court could have.
So you would contend it would be discretionary at that point?
Yes, I believe that I believe the court could have made an inquiry, because what the and if you look at Morales and Kimberlin, they talk about inter-jury influences being verboten after a jury has returned its verdict. So I see this court making that distinction in Morales, and I assume the court would at least have the discretion to inquire if this had come to its attention prior to a verdict, because it is the finality of the verdict is the policy of that is driving the extrajudicial rule of or the extrajudicial prejudice or the extrajudicial considerations that this court is prohibited, and what's driving that rule is the finality of the judgment.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Holmes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government indicated that the decision or the statements were at least based on evidence. It's important to look at where this initial statement had to have occurred during the trial. During the first day of the trial, the witnesses were the bank employees. None of these bank employees...
When did the co-defendants testify?
The co-defendants testified the first day and part of the second day. So
and they implicated Ms. Farmer pretty substantially, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Although they had motivation.
They had motivation to implicate Ms. Farmer. There were a lot of inconsistencies, and that's part of the credibility of the witness, the factual scenario. The decision was made before the evidence regarding the
You can have another minute.
Okay, thank you. The evidence occurred prior. These statements occurred prior to the evidence regarding the cell phone records, the fingerprint examinations, the handwriting sample. All this was, and more importantly, before the defense's case. Ms. Farmer testified. Ms. Farmer had a number of witnesses to testify in that case. You have the co-defendants who allegedly ride this great distance with Shelley Mattingly, Ms. Farmer's patient, and they can't tell what race she is. It's just there were a lot of things that did not make sense from their testimony, and if you look at that in context with this decision already made up, it makes more sense at that point for the decision and the verdict that the jury made, because it was not based on evidence. It was based on a pre-decided notion that violates the Constitution and the court's instructions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, and thanks to both counsel, and a special thanks from the court to you, Mr. Holmes, for accepting appointment in this case and so vigorously representing Ms. Farmer both here and at trial.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With that, we'll be in recess for the day to resume tomorrow morning.